bringing you the latest in tax credit news, insight, and analysis. This is Tax Credit Tuesday with your host, Michael Novogratz.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogratz, and this is Tax Credit Tuesday. This is the April 23rd, 2024 podcast. As our viewers on YouTube can see, I'm pleased to have as my guest this week, my partner, John DeJobini, who works out of Novogratz's Cleveland, Ohio office. John is one of Novogratz's leading historic tax credit experts, which is why, no surprise, he's my guest today. We're going to discuss the role in some of the sources of gap financing when you're using historic tax credits to preserve America's built history. Now, in discussing gap financing, we're going to discuss two aspects. First, we're going to discuss the role of gap financing during the construction phase up to permit loan funding of a development. At this point, gap financing is used to bridge the gap between when permanent funding sources are available and when they are needed to fund development costs. Then second, John will share some of the many sources of long-term gap financing. In this context, gap financing refers to sources of long-term financing beyond some of the common sources that are used to finance historic tax credit properties. Long-term gap financing is increasingly important at this time, not just for historic tax credit development, but all sorts of developments. That's because interest rates have been on an upward slope, to say the least. Insurance rates have been climbing at double-digit percentage rates annually. And of course, the cost of construction and labor have been on the rise, even though they have softened, the rate of increase has softened of late. Now, when we think about the common sources of historic tax credit financing, think of traditional investor equity that's based on future cash flow. Also think of long-term permanent financing, which is hard debt based that's sized based on projected net operating income. And then, of course, in historic tax credit developments, you have tax credit investor equity that's generated from syndicating federal tax credits. Often, federal tax credits are claimed in combination with state-level historic tax credits. I was talking to John in preparing for the podcast that we might be having a future podcast on state credits and historic properties. Now, John and I are going to discuss the intersection between historic tax credits and other tax credit financing incentives as well. When you think about the intersection of historic tax credits, you can think of historic tax credits combined with long-term housing tax credits to develop affordable residential housing, or combined in combination with the new markets tax credit, as well as combined with the opportunity zone incentive and to a lesser extent, renewable energy tax credits. Of course, we're going to delve deeper in each of these topics in today's episode. It's the purpose of the episode, and we do have a lot to talk about. So if you're ready, let's get started. John, welcome back to Tax Credit Tuesday.
Thank you, Mike. Very excited to be back. It's been almost a year, and I'm very excited for today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming back. And other partners were as fortunate to do it after busy season. But I appreciate the guests that made it during busy season. But before we discuss today's topic, I thought it would be good for you to share with our listeners some information about the various services you do provide to Novogratz clients.
Absolutely. So in regards to gap financing, a lot of the core services that I do are related to forecasting and consulting work that we're doing at the front end working towards a financial closing. And this has to do with historic tax credits, of course, but also has to do with low-income housing and new market tax credits. And once we get past that, you know, initial forecast and consulting services and close the deal, we also have services that we do during construction, coming out of construction when we do the cost certification and audit the cost to determine the amount of tax credits a project will be eligible for, and then audit and tax compliance work during the compliance period, and then at the back end when we eventually have an exit from some of these investors leaving. So I'm lucky enough to see some of these deals from an initial closing through an entire compliance period and exit, and see how historic tax credits and these other credits can successfully help some of these projects get closed, and lucky to do that as what I do for a job. So,
great. Thank you for that. And it is interesting to see the full cycle of these transactions, but the historic tax credits generally being a 5 to 7 year frame, a new markets, you know, 7 to 9 years. And then long for the tax credits were like 17 to 19. But so you have to be around a while to see the full cycle for long for the tax credits. So I did have our former partner, Tom Bosch, on a while ago, and we did talk a lot about historic tax credits and timing and what a central factor that is. I thought it'd be useful to get your thoughts on timing from the standpoint of a historic tax credit development, and maybe when a developer ought to be reaching out to you, at what part of the process.
Absolutely. I'm glad you bring this up, because this comes up a lot when I talk to developers. And of course, the answer is going to be very early in the process. Even if it's just doing a preliminary set of numbers, having us engaged so we're there to help with consulting, I think this is, you know, extraordinarily helpful. And then when you have these gap financing sources involved as well, it even makes it more beneficial to get involved early. I typically like to be involved before term sheets are signed from investors and from lenders, so we can help in, you know, structuring that, putting together the total sources and uses, and looking for any opportunities to maximize those sources and minimize the amount of developer equity that's needed to source these projects.
Yeah, and I know as much as you prefer to be involved before those term sheets are signed, oftentimes the lender or the, you know, tax credit syndicator will tell the developer, please go talk to John or someone else who can help you with your numbers and the rest in advance of us signing the term sheet.
That's absolutely true, Mike.
So now in the intro, I discussed the role of gap financing during construction, and then as well as the need for long-term sources of gap financing. But I wanted to start with gap financing during construction, because oftentimes when I think of gap financing, I think of it as, what are my long-term sources? What are my development costs? And there's a gap, but there's also during construction, there can be gaps. And that's one of the reasons why those monthly cash flow projections during development are so important.
Very.
Because bills don't get paid just once a year during construction. So if you could share with our audience some of the reasons bridge financing is needed, I think that would be helpful during construction.
Absolutely. So this is a conversation I find myself having with developers very often recently, and in developers particularly that are new to historic tax credits. So with historic tax credits, you've got the historic tax credits that a project will generate, both federal and state, that will convert to some sort of HTC equity, you know, based upon the pricing. But we also need to get that into construction for a source. And with the federal historic tax credit, what you'll typically see is that 25% of federal historic tax credit equity will be available at the financial close and for construction. And the reason that it's 25% is the revenue procedure 2014-12 that really dictates a lot of how historic tax credit transactions are structured. Notes that at least 20% of a federal investor's equity has to be in the deal before you place in service. So typically, federal investors will put 25% in order to provide some cushion in case your QREs and tax credits come in higher than anticipated. So you usually have 25% of your federal equity at close, but the remainder is not going to come in until after you place in service. And then for state historic tax credits, typically, all of that equity comes in after placed in service. So both 75% of your federal equity and usually 100% of your state equity aren't available until after you've placed in service. So in order to help bridge that gap, there have been lenders that have established, you know, what we call as historic tax credit bridge loans. And these bridge loans are specifically secured by that future tax credit equity. And so because it's secured by that equity, we generally see lenders get a little bit more comfortable and the rates can be a little bit more favorable than you'd see with construction lending rates. I'm typically seeing in the 7 to 8% range for these tax credit bridge loans. And they can come from both lenders that are specifically, you know, looking to make these types of loans. And then also some syndicators and investors will also make these loans to pair with the syndication or investing that they're doing in order to kind of offer an all-in-one stop shop for developers.
And then what is the rough loan percentage? If you think of like the future equity contributions, what percentage of the future equity contributions can a developer generally receive in terms of a cash payment or a cash loan?
Sure. That's a great question and something that I find myself explaining often. So you'll typically see 90 to 95% of the future equity being bridged. And the reason that they don't want to bridge up to 100% of that future equity is because, you know, there's concern that if your credits come in lower than anticipated, or if there was any timing adjusters that were in place, then you might not have enough equity to pay down their bridge loan. And that's the real security. And, you know, their ultimate goal is to have that tax credit equity come in and directly pay down that loan. Additionally, I'll add that any tax credit equity that's tied to a debt service coverage ratio typically won't be bridged, because lenders won't feel confident enough that equity will come in when needed to pay down that loan. So that's another aspect that developers need to be cognizant of, is that there'll be these two pieces here where they may not be able to bridge all of those amounts.
No, that's a good point. You focused here, of course, on bridging the historic tax credit equity and state tax credit equity. It can also be used for other sort of soft sources, which we won't kind of go into here. And I would just note for our listeners that the construction loan, you know, loan to value and the rest, you know, you generally will want to be maxing out a construction loan depending upon the terms. It's just maxing out a construction loan doesn't provide enough equity or enough sources during the development phase. And I would also note that there's a bit of an iterative calculation here, because the interest on the bridge loan does get capitalized to the extent it's attributable to the development cost rather than acquisition. It does get capitalized to the renovation, a large portion of which will end up being historic, will be end up tax credit eligible, which does end up generating a slightly higher source.
That's correct.
And then there is there's other techniques through avoided costs and the rest to, you know, capitalize some potential operating expenses and the rest to eligible basis. But that's not what this podcast is about. So reach out to John for some of those others, but there's definitely ways in which your historic tax credit eligible basis can be higher than you might think right off the bat.
That's a great point, Mike. And both QRE eligible and generate more federal credits and state credits. Right. So it may be 30% of, you know, you might be able to get, you know, a 30% back in tax credits, which is a reduction of your interest from that perspective. So that can be really helpful. And one other thing I wanted to add with those future proceeds that are not able to be bridged, that 5 to 10% of federal and state equity and anything that's tied to debt service coverage ratio, I often find myself helping developers find specific uses that they can use for those dollars, such as paying developer fee or funding reserves or any other specific uses that can be identified that don't need to be paid during construction. The overall goal to keep developer equity necessary at close as low as possible. So that's one of the ways I find that we can really be beneficial to the developer.
Thank you for that, John. So that's the bridge loans as gap financing during the construction. And when I think of construction, I think of through permanent loan funding and your final funding of your historic tax credit equity. Now let's turn to long-term sources of gap financing. And anyone who's developed an historic property before knows there can be multiple types of long-term source of gap financing. In preparing for the podcast, though, we came up with three broad categories. One, property assessed clean energy, also known as PACE. The second being tax increment financing / pilot payments in lieu of taxes backed financing. And then the third is a broad category of other state, local, you know, other municipal sources. So I thought we'd start with PACE. And if you could describe how PACE financing acts as providing additional sort of longer term gap finance.
Sure. So PACE works well in historic tax credits because it can be a subordinate form of financing to a construction or perm loan. And, you know, as we've talked about, the lending market has gotten a little tighter over the past couple years. So finding this additional source of financing can be particularly beneficial. And typically what we've seen in these deals is that the PACE eligible costs, there's usually more than enough to go around in these deals when you're rehabilitating a historic project. So finding enough costs that are PACE eligible, I haven't found to be an issue when a developer has PACE financing. So typically you're going to be restrained just by your overall debt service coverage ratio. And, you know, with the construction lender maybe only wanting to lend to a 1.4, you may be able to get this additional form of financing and be able to get that debt service coverage ratio down to 1.2 and get those additional long-term sources into the deal in order to finance the historic tax credit deal.
No, I'm glad that we started with that because it is sort of a type of mezzanine or second mortgage financing that lets you borrow against that cash flow that the permanent lender is in their conservative underwriting letting you borrow against it. So it is hard debt in the sense that it's not soft and the repayment terms are fixed, but it allows you to borrow against more of your projected cash flow, which generally be cheaper than any investor equity that you're generating.
That's
so
right.
PACE financing to that end does have a lot in common with tax increment financing. And tax increment financing can have a multitude of definitions in different circumstances. But if you could describe for our listeners what TIF is in this context and how it can be used to generate long-term financing.
Absolutely. So I think that it's similar in that it's going to be that subordinate form of financing to a construction loan and allow, you know, more financing sources to get into the deal here. Also, it's going to vary by city, state, and municipality, depending on the specific programs for TIF financing. So the TIF financing that I've seen is it works by allowing an increase in assessed value of an improvement of real property to be exempt from real estate taxes. And that may come in the way of a developer making payments in lieu of taxes instead that effectively pays the interest and principal on that TIF financing. Or there may be a developer may pay real estate taxes and then get TIF rebates that are applied to that TIF financing. So there's different ways that it can work. But what we've generally seen is a way to supplement the construction loan and get additional sources into the deal. Also worth mentioning that there's an assignment of all incremental taxes as part of this, and that it's the underlying security for these loans that allows it to be subordinate to the construction.
I think of PACE financing where, you know, the improvements that you're making or a lot of those improvements you'll make anyways because of the historic nature of the development and such. So you really, you know, in PACE financing, you're taking the net operating income, you can borrow more against a given projected net operating income. And then with TIF financing, you're looking at your projected operating expenses, including higher real estate taxes, and saying, okay, I now I'm not going to have higher real estate taxes. I'm going to have lower real estate taxes. And what I would have used for real estate taxes that I can borrow against and get the TIF financing. Or as you mentioned, I'll pay the real estate tax to get a rebate, and I can use a rebate, you know, as a source of additional long-term financing. So, you know, that said, are there other ways in which you think of tax increment financing being similar or dissimilar with PACE financing?
I do. And I see similar ways that I can be helpful in the consulting and forecasting realm with these. So they may have requirements on the dollars that those amounts can pay for, how the interest is calculated on these loans can differ. Sometimes I've seen some of these loans require interest to be paid on the entire loan from closing. So it may present a higher interest cost than a developer originally anticipated because of the way the interest is calculated. I also see how the interest reserves are structured to be similar. Usually they're holding back the dollars to pay the interest on these loans at the closing date. So they ensure that they have enough of the loan withheld to pay the interest for the period that they've deemed necessary through construction and stabilization, essentially. And then also see that there's similarities in how we want to model the repayment terms of these deals or of these loans, so we can accurately show what the developer's cash flow looks like when you have these loans in place and that they're properly getting serviced. So they certainly can add some complications to how we're doing this and adds to that point of, you know, getting us involved early so we can make sure we have a full picture of what your sources and uses look like and how that all adds up together.
Yeah. So much of this comes back to reading the documents and making sure that we're calculating the payment streams, both when you'll get the money and how much you're going to owe and when. Oftentimes what one thinks the agreement is, when you read the documents, there can be some oversights that you want to avoid. So I did want to move now to our catch-all category, our third, which was, broadly speaking, you know, city, state, and other municipal financing. And this is would really be an endless topic. But I know that in our preparation for the podcast, you created a handful of buckets of some of the various sources. And I'd actually encourage the listeners, they want to email additional sources that we're not talking about here, to cpsnovaco.com. We'd love to receive your ideas of some, you know, unique additional sources. But with that as kind of the intro, I'll let you start to discuss, you know, some of the broad categories of city, state, and local soft financing.
Sure. So one of the ones I see very typically in these historic tax credit deals is related to brownfield or grayfields. So grayfields are former commercial or retail shopping sites that are abandoned due to newer developments. And then brownfields are former industrial or commercial property that's no longer in use because of hazardous waste or other soil containment or contamination. So those can fit well with historic tax credit deals where you've got a historic building that hasn't been used for a while, and maybe it's because of some hazardous waste or containment or asbestos that's there. So developers finding ways to, you know, look in their municipality, your city or state, and see if there's any opportunities for brownfield or grayfield credits or grants can be a powerful adder. I've seen credits and, you know, a state may have a program where you can get an additional tax credit on top of the federal historic tax credit and on top of the state historic tax credit, but can also get a brownfield or grayfield credit. And each state will have their own specific rules that go along with that, which may require a cost certification and something that we can certainly help with if it's a credit. But there also may be opportunities when there's a grant, and that kind of feeds right into to one of the other ones we wanted to talk about. We see a lot of grants in these projects. And one of the key things that, you know, I'd recommend to a developer, you know, we're CPAs, so we're not necessarily going out and finding these sources, but developers talking to their constituents and people in their local municipalities about what may be available to them as far as grants or other subsidies to their project, I think is really beneficial. It may be from the Historic Preservation Office that it's available, or from other economic development organizations that may provide grants or other subsidies to projects. But I think there's, you know, planning that needs to go into this, and you want to avoid pitfalls where you go out and find a grant or some sort of dollars, but also may find a big tax bill if that's a grant that's coming into your project very early on before you're placing in service. You may find that you owe a large tax bill on that because your project's out of service at that time and not producing any depreciation. Where, you know, on the contrary, if we can maybe do some planning and think through a structure where we can minimize that tax impact or push out those grant dollars to the year that you place in service, so maybe you can offset it with depreciation. I think there's some good opportunities there to, you know, in order to best utilize these dollars and maximize how much they can benefit a project.
No, super. Thanks for that. And as I mentioned, lots of other sources. So please email us at cbs@navigo.com if you have some that you think are worth highlighting. So John, I did also mention in the intro that we're going to talk a bit about combining historic tax credits with other tax credits or tax incentives. And I'd like you to think about this as a lightning.
Love it, Mike. I love it.
Once again, we could do an entire podcast on historic tax credits combined with a log mounting tax credit. We could do an entire podcast on historic tax credits combined with Demarcus tax credits, as well as with Opportunity Zones incentive, as well as the renewable energy tax credits. With that said, starting our lightning round, what's your advice for client that's thinking of combining historic tax credits with log mounting tax credits?
First of all, I love the lightning round, Mike, because, you know, we were planning for this and I was sort of thinking about it that way. So I'm glad you framed it ahead of time that way. It's I think that's a great way to do it. So with the LIHTC credit and pairing with historic, I think there's two distinct ways that you can do this. So first, there's a direct LIHTC historic deal where the same investor will get both the LIHTC and the historic credit. And in this case, you may see a little bit better pricing on the historic tax credit than you would if you do the lease pass-through structure, because the same investor is getting both credits and a LIHTC investor will look at that as a supplement because they're getting that credit earlier than some of the LIHTC credit that they're getting over 10 years. And additionally, it can be easier to manage those deals because you just have one investor. You don't have this lease pass-through structure that can complicate both the closing process and the compliance period. But doing the lease pass-through structure can be beneficial, and having two separate investors can be beneficial. And the main reason is because there's no basis reduction when you have the lease pass-through structure. And so if you have a 4% LIHTC deal, you can maximize your 4% credits and also maximize your historic credits. And if you have 4% and you're in an eligible zone as well and get the 130% 4% credit, it makes it all the more beneficial. So I think there's some really good math that goes along with, you know, doing that analysis and determining which path is best. But I think it's a great analysis to do and really interesting when you're looking at the direct or lease pass-through structure for LIHTC and historic.
One observation I would make in a lightning round is you have to decide which of the two, broadly speaking, which of the two structures to use. And there's pros and cons of each, and it's ultimately a number running game. But now let's turn to new markets tax credits and combining those with historic tax credits.
Okay. So new markets and historics, I think I see that those work together well, and I see them in a lot of deals together. Reasons that they can work together well is the historic equity can oftentimes be used as a source for the new market tax credit leverage loan. So it can pair well with that. And then also see that there's historic tax credit investors that also may have new market tax credit allocation. So I see situations where you may be able to have a similar investor or same investor that is interested in doing both the new markets and the historics in order to get that those both of those credits into the deal.
Thank you for that. At some level, I think about new markets as somewhat similar to LIHTC in the sense that either the historic tax credit equity can be the same as the new market tax credit equity, or the new market tax credit financing comes in as a subsidized loan. So you still have the structural question that's somewhat similar to the law for the tax credit. Now let's move on to opportunity zones. Roughly half of all historic tax credits developments are in opportunity zones. And with that said, what advice do you have for listeners who are thinking about combining opportunity zone equity with historic tax credits?
Sure. So I see two main ways that opportunity zone equity can benefit a historic tax credit project. From a gap financing perspective, if there is additional equity that may be needed that a developer is looking to have an outside investor bring in, it can be more attractive if a development's in an opportunity zone and that investor has capital gains that can be used for opportunity zone benefits. And the second way is developers considering to run any equity that they have also through a QAF in order to get the benefits of opportunity zones. With the 10-year hold benefit, you know, being so strong and you're going through a 2-year construction period and a 5-year compliance period, you know, you're most of the way there to that 10-year hold as it goes there. So, you know, trying to find a way to structure their deal as an opportunity zone investment, I think can be really beneficial to invest or to historic tax credit developers and can add some real economic benefit down the road on a potential sale for them.
Lastly, and this will be a real fast lightning round, what about combining historic tax credits and renewable energy tax credits?
Sure. So I don't see this happening a whole lot, but we'll note the sidewalk rule that if you're going to add solar panels, you have to think about, can you see them from the sidewalk, or are they set back far enough in order to not be seen and not affect the historic view, basically, of the building. So I think that's one of the key things to keep in mind.
I'll agree with that. You don't want to visually affect the architectural integrity of the historic building by seeing solar panels from the sidewalk. And I'd also encourage listeners to email us anything else they're hearing about combining renewable energy tax credits with historic properties, because that's definitely one where you're at odds with trying to gain energy efficiency and be green, but at the same time, preserving architectural integrity. So, John, I will include your contact information in the show notes, but I did want you to also share for our audience some of the other resources available for those listeners that want to learn more about historic tax credits and gap financing.
Absolutely. So of course, the services I mentioned earlier, forecasting, consulting, audit, tax work. I'm more than available to discuss historic tax credit, LIHTC, new market projects, and help developers with those. But additionally, would want to note the upcoming Journal of Tax Credits issue that's coming out. that's focused on gap financed. And I will have an article in there about bridge loans that I recommend folks to read. Additionally, the Historic Tax Credit Handbook, which is a great resource and can be found on our website. I am always looking at that to review certain historic tax credit items, and it's immensely beneficial. And then the final thing I'll mention is our upcoming Historic Tax Credit Conference that will be in Kansas City this year in October at the Intercontinental Hotel. And of course, looking forward to that and connecting with all of the folks in the historic tax credit community.
Right. Thank you for that. And I'll include links to those in the podcast show notes. And as I mentioned, I will include John's contact information in the show notes and encourage our listeners to reach out to John with historic tax credit preservation questions. And I'd also like to remind our audience to subscribe to Tax Credit Tuesday on your favorite podcast platforms. Make sure you don't miss an episode. If there's a platform we're not on that we should be on, let us know that as well. So, John, I appreciate you joining us on the podcast today. But you're not done yet. As you know from your last visit, we have an off-mic section. But what's different from the last time you were on is one of our partners, Tony Capone, initially used this space instead of answering a question, but to give a shout out to someone working in the industry. And for him, it was renewable energy industry. So I thought I would ask you to give a shout out to someone working in historic preservation who you think has done a lot to preserve the built architecture of the United States.
Absolutely. I love this idea, and shout out to Tony Capone for that, this great idea.
You get more than one shout out.
Well, I was already going to take two. I hope that's all right.
That's true. It's okay. It's okay. Okay. Loud.
All right. Well, so the first one I had was Cindy Hamilton. So she's the president at Heritage Consulting Group. And Heritage Consulting does the SHPO and NPS documents to help get these historic projects certified by the National Park Services. She is a Historic Tax Credit Coalition board member, and that's a group that works to expand the historic tax credit. And so she works with them in order to continue to grow the historic tax credit and ensure that we have it going forward to preserve our buildings. And just from my personal experience on working with her and her team on many projects, they've just worked diligently with so many developers to help get so many projects developed by, you know, working through those documents with SHPO and NPS. So shout out to Cindy Hamilton.
Let me just, before you give your next shout out, though, let me just say, if you're wondering what SHPO and NPS stands for, email John. Go
okay.
ahead. Your next shout out.
Good tease, Mike. All right. And then my second one is to Tom Boscia, who was my former partner here in the Cleveland office and who I worked with for 15 years in historic tax credits and was really a mentor to me over these past 15 years. And so Tom just recently retired from Novogradac. So I wanted to give a shout out to him. He was instrumental to the historic tax credit program and, you know, led us through some trying times when we had the revenue procedure and 50D income guidance that was presented. And he was instrumental in helping the historic tax credit industry basically digest and be able to work through those things and, you know, continue to get us to where we are today with the historic tax credit industry, and was also immensely beneficial to me and helping to, you know, help to get me to be a partner here at Novogradac, which I appreciate very much. So had to do the double shout out today, Mike.
Double shout out. I love it. And I'll give a shout out or echo your shout out to Cindy Hamilton as well and all the work that she's done on behalf of the Historic Tax Credit Coalition. And it's a pleasure to be a fellow board member with her there. And then also obviously for Tom Boscia, as you know, he retired last year and he was a great partner for many, many years. I do miss working with him still, but I know that he's enjoying his retirement. Thank you, John. I appreciate you joining me. I look forward to having you back. And to our listeners, I'm Mike Novogradic. Thanks for listening.
This weekly podcast has been brought to you by Novogradic & Company, LLP. Archived podcasts are available online at www.novoco.com/podcast or by subscribing to the Tax Credit Tuesday podcast in iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Radio Public. You can find related links referenced in this podcast on our website at www.novoco.com/podcast. Novogradic & Company, LLP is a national certified public accounting and consulting firm with offices nationwide. Learn more about our professional services at www.novoco.com.